today. Today's sermon is supposed to be called, What If Heaven Is For Real And It's Here? In fact, that's what I announced at the beginning of the service. What if heaven is for real and it's here? But I want you to know I've cut the sermon in half. And that wasn't because I want to get finished early. It was for a really good reason, but I'm not going to share that with you right now. I will get back to it. But to start with, I want to know, would you raise your hand, how many of you believe heaven is for real? Heaven, oh. I knew there would be a lot of hands up. That's a whole lot of hands. And I'm not surprised, because research suggests that there are over 2 billion Christians in the world, and most of them believe in heaven and hell. And in the United States, regardless of what religion people claim to be, 72% of us believe in an actual heaven, and 58% of us in an actual hell. So just a quick little math note. That means that 14% more people believe in an actual heaven than believe in an actual hell. And you realize there's a whole sermon in that discrepancy, right? But that's not where I'm going with this. Most of you here right now believe that heaven is for real. And I do not intend to change a single mind. But before I get too deeply into whether heaven is for real, let me offer to you what I mean whenever I talk about heaven today. I don't think many of us believe anymore in an opulent city with streets of gold and palatial mansions. In fact, have you noticed that over time our biblical translations have moved away from "in my Father's house are many mansions" and opted instead for rooms or dwelling places? And I love that change. Not only is it a move away from earthly materialism, but it introduces the idea of dwelling with the indwelling God. Some people's understanding of heaven is based on the descriptions of people who have had near-death experiences. After young Colton Burpo survived a serious health crisis, the things he remembered from the experience ended up in a book called Heaven is for Real. How many of you have read Heaven is for Real? Or I think there was a movie, too. Colton described in pretty vivid detail thrones and angels and Jesus. But that's not what I'm talking about today either. When I talk about heaven today, I'm talking more about the list of things that Christians and people of other faiths report pretty consistently after their near-death experiences. They report positive emotions, being outside of their bodies, the feeling of moving through a tunnel, visions of a great light. You know, when my mom had a really serious illness and a hospitalization, I put my arms around her. I said, "Mama, if you see the light, don't go. Don't go." It wasn't her time. But people report seeing the great light and awareness of family and friends who've died, and some kind of review of the events of their lives. In an effort to remain intellectually honest, I do want to mention that some people have experienced near-death experiences that are harrowing, that are hostile, that they sometimes describe as hellish. But for tonight, it is the light and the loved ones and the lack of fear that I am referring to when I say heaven. We're going to turn to the scriptures now, and specifically Paul's second letter to the Corinthians, beginning with the second verse of the 12th chapter. Did you know that Paul himself reported a near-death experience? He doesn't say so in so many words, but scholars have put together contextual clues that they believe are evidence that Paul had such an experience. And we certainly know that at least once Paul was stoned and dragged out of the city and left for dead. So it all adds up. In Paul's near-death experience, he claims to have witnessed a third heaven. And when I'm reading his account, I don't want you to get lost in what the third heaven might be. Paul's contemporaries believed that there were three heavens. There was the air where the birds flew. There was the atmosphere where the stars and the moon were. And then there was a third heaven that was God's home, or God's dwelling. So here we go, 2 Corinthians 12. I know a person in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. God knows. And I know that such a person, whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know, God knows, was caught up into paradise and heard things that are not to be told, that no mortal is permitted to repeat. On behalf of such one, I will boast, but on my own behalf, I will not boast except about my weaknesses. I will not be a fool, for I will be speaking the truth, but I refrain from it so that no one may think better of me than what is seen in me or heard from me, even considering the exceptional character of the revelations. Therefore, to keep me from being too elated, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me, to keep me from being too elated. Three times I appealed to the Lord about this, that it would leave me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for power is made perfect in weakness. So I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may dwell in me. Therefore, I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities for the sake of Christ. For whenever I am weak, then I am strong. So Paul starts out, I know a man in Christ who 14 years ago was caught up to the third heaven. And that's an odd way to start, right? If this is Paul's own experience. But you should know that in Paul's day, saying something like, I know a man who, was a form of personal modesty. Paul separated himself from the story and told it in third person so as not to be seen as bragging. And it's kind of convenient, isn't it, for Paul to say he heard things that are not to be told. You know, so it's like, this thing was so amazing and all, but I'm not going to tell you anything about it because I'm not allowed to. And it kind of gives you pause. But I don't think really that should cast doubt on whether Paul actually had this experience. I think Paul just realized the limitations of trying to describe this heavenly experience he had. John Shelby Spong has said that trying to speak about God and describe the aspects and attributes of God is like a horse trying to communicate what it means to be human. We don't have the capacity of language, Spong says, to properly talk about God. And here's a possibility. What if Paul can simply be taken at his word? What if he is refusing to boast about the experience because he doesn't want to elevate himself for having had the experience? You know, Paul often talked about the people that had quit listening to him and were following other teachers, those more charismatic teachers, probably younger, maybe better dressed, I don't know. But Paul could have scored major points by getting people all wrapped up in his account of heaven. He would have been a rock star. People then, as many are now, were fascinated by the idea of heaven. But no, Paul did not want to focus on his supernatural experience. He wanted the people to focus on Christ, whose grace is sufficient, and whose power is made perfect in weakness. Today, I want to take a page from Paul's book. I want us not to get too wrapped up in indescribable details or physical manifestations or anything for which we honestly have no language. I don't want us to be so focused on what heaven is that we don't consider what it is all about. Like my professor used to say, I don't care if the serpent in the garden actually spoke. But what did he say? I don't care so much about what heaven looks like or its theological implications. I care about what heaven is to me. So many of us are fascinated with heaven. Why? Well, here are some reasons that I think heaven is important to us. First, we want to know that we will be okay if there is an eternity. The idea of eternity is scary, especially since we have no idea what to expect from that eternity. But here's an idea that I take comfort in. Eternity has no end. It stretches backward and it stretches forward. So if you believe there is eternity yet to come, then you must believe an eternity has already been. And in that eternity, you were fine. During the eternity before your conscience, you didn't suffer. You weren't frightened. You didn't feel isolated. There is no reason to fear those things in the eternity that is your future. And second, I think heaven is important to us because we want to believe that we will one day stand in the presence of God. This from a distance thing of worshiping and walking with God is difficult sometimes. We're having to take an awful lot on faith, aren't we? But I want to encourage you to remember the example of Jesus. Jesus was so close to God, so close in relationship, that he could glance up and see God, hear God, experience the heavens torn apart, and allowing direct access to God. For Jesus, heaven was right here. No chasm between himself and God. I believe we can live in the real presence of God just like that. Jesus told us over and over that it was possible. And I think we trust that heaven is real because we want God to be all-powerful, in control. Confronted by the everyday presence of evil, we're like the Jews of Jesus' time. They told themselves that God could end suffering, God could defeat malevolent powers, God could cure disease. And the fact that God hadn't yet done those things didn't mean that God never would. The idea of heaven allows us to be patient as we wait for a day in the future when God will take control of everything. Fourth, we want to know that we have not lost our loved ones forever. My first experience with death of a loved one, of a person very close to me, was my grandfather. And several years after my grandfather passed away, I came out with a song called When I Get Where I'm Going. Brad Paisley and a little Dolly Parton in the background, how could it go wrong, right? And the song was called When I Get Where I'm Going. Listen to a little bit. When I get where I'm going, yeah. All right. When I get where I'm going, there'll be only happy tears. I will shed the sins and struggles I have carried all these years. And I'll leave my heart wide open. I will love and have no fear. When I get where I'm going, don't cry for me down here. And then the chorus, the second verse. I'm going to walk with my granddaddy, and he'll match me step for step. And I'll tell him how I missed him every minute since he left. Does that song hold up theologically? Not exactly. But who cares? The feeling of the song washes over me. I'm going to walk with my granddaddy, and he'll match me step for step. And I'll tell him how I missed him every minute since he left. And I'll tell my grandma, and I'll tell Judy and Glenn and Jim and Sue and Bryn and Uncle Fred and Shorty and Paul. Now that's a picture of heaven that I need. And number five. Well, I'm leaving out number five. Remember how at the beginning of the sermon I told you that I started out with a sermon title, What If Heaven Is For Real And It's Here? What I intended to do is make sure you understood that heaven belongs to those who feed the hungry, welcome the stranger, visit the prisoner. I had a whole social justice thing ready, and I was right. You have responsibilities, I was going to remind you. And then I remembered all those teachers who say that above all, doctrines about heaven and hell have been intended to control us, to make us afraid and make us compliant. Don't want to go to hell? Do this. Want to go to heaven? Do this. And I don't want to be that person. So no number five. Let's end with this, number six. I think we hold on to heaven because we know, like Shakespeare said, that death, a necessary end, will come when it will come. But God, how hard it is. How often we are unready for it. How often we are devastated by it. How often we think we are finally okay again, and then we are overcome by the grief of losing a loved one. Several years ago, I had an experience. This body had a lot of knee pain. And I asked my friends, what do you do when you have knee pain? What doctor do you go to see? And my friend Becky assured me that she knew the best doctor, not only in Austin, but probably in the world. He just happened to be in Austin, and he had this degree and that degree, and he would take care of it. And I finally got an appointment with the amazing doctor, and I was in his office, and he held up my MRI image. He said, 40% of the population has this type of injuries. Most of them are asymptomatic. I think you need a little rest, and I recommend 6 weeks of physical therapy. On my second visit to the physical therapist, as she watched my knee move in several directions it should not have, and saw how hard I was trying not to cry, she said, "I don't think we can do it this way. Maybe you should see another doctor." So I went to another doctor. He described himself as low tech and high touch. I told him what the previous doctor had said. He nodded. He took the images of my MRI out of the envelope. He held them up. He put them aside. He looked at me and said, "The key for me is that you're in pain." Oh, how I loved him. When our loved ones die, we're in pain. When we contemplate our own lives and what we might regret, we're in pain. When we think of the sadness others will feel when we leave them, we're in pain. Jesus certainly understands this. And so Jesus didn't leave us a map or an MRI or a complicated theological treatise. Instead, he left us a promise. Let that promise wash over you this morning like a poem, like a song, like a prayer. Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many dwelling places. If it were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you? And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you with me, so that where I am, you may be there also. And you know the way to the place where I am going.